Our next presenter is David J. Deal. He's the library director at Texas State Technical College. He's also the label coordinator for the AVRL and author of The Blue Pages, a guide to 78 RPM party records. And he's going to tell us about discographical challenges of Sub Rosa recordings.
All right, discographical challenges of Sub Rosa recordings. That's the kind of title you dream up when you have to get permission from your dean to take time off. You don't exactly say, hey boss, I'm going to go talk about party records. But that's basically what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about discographical challenges. We're not here to challenge your sensibilities. Well, I can try. Well, just, that's right. Whoops. If you hear a big bang, it just means the microphone fell off. This is not my life's work, by the way. Most of the people you've seen up here have spent years and years delving and digging around for this stuff. What happened is, after last year's ARS convention, Kurt Nock gave me a call and asked me to be the label coordinator for party records. At that time, I had a box of about 25 and a pile of old record research magazines, and that was about the extent of my knowledge of party records. But I said, sure, would have been nice if they'd asked me to do Jeanette's or something, but you take what they give you, right? So what are the discographical challenges of these party records? Well, the first one is simply acceptance. Why are you bothering? I mean, most of you have the image of some third-rate comic. They sober him up for a morning, get him in a basement someplace with a microphone and a cutter, and he does his thing and it gets it issued. And that's sometimes true. But there are a lot of very high-class, well-rehearsed, and very well-paid party performers. People like Dwight Fisk, who made lots and lots of records. He worked at the Savoy Plaza Hotel in New York City for years, was paid top dollar during the Depression when everybody else was starving to death, because his clientele was not some WPA worker who was feeding nickels into the slot. His clientele was the people who were not affected by the Depression one little bit, and continued to go out and have fun every night. And they liked their fun a little bit racy. Not too broad, not too offensive, witty, colorful, lively. That's what they were looking for. And these people would come from Omaha and way out in the sticks. It would be an annual event for them to come to New York City. Ooh, big time. Go to a midnight show with Dwight Fisk. Maybe take home a couple of his albums to while away the hours for the rest of the year when the crops were in and all that stuff. So really there are two different worlds involved with party records. And being the dedicated researcher I am, I'm going to cover them both. So once we get past the simple acceptance, whether it's artistic or worthy of preservation at all or not, one of the biggest challenges is simply getting biographical material on these people. You just can't go to the Guinness Book of Popular Music and open it up like you can for, say, Bing Crosby or somebody, and find out basic information like when they were born, where they were born. Sometimes you can't even find out their real names.
Why they were born.
That's a song. I remember that. And a case in point is Spivey, or Spivey. Maybe somebody from New York City knows how to pronounce that name. Spivey.
But it's not Victoria Spivey.
No relation to the blues singer Victoria Spivey. Definitely not. But she was one of these very sophisticated, very well-paid, carefully rehearsed people who regaled movie stars, the upper crust of New York City. Eventually, she got her own club called Spivey's or Spivey's Roof. It was up in the penthouse, and that was from about 1940 to the early 50s. She did very well for herself. And once that kind of petered out, she became a character actress. She appeared in films like The Manchurian Candidate. She was in Requiem for Heavyweight and several other things. So this is not, again, some fallen down drunk that they just dragged out and said, make a couple records. But she did make a few records, not an awful lot. And if I'm a master of technology here, that's a little dark. Sorry about that. This is a Commodore record. Commodore, of course, being famous as a jazz label. What they did was they bought the old General Corporation, which I assume the idea was to get the Jelly Roll Morton sides, but these came along with it. The album you saw before was the General album, and so they just started up a celebrity series, and it's in a 51, 52, and 53 numbering system. Just like the Commodores, they give you the date it was recorded, October 1939. And we're going to hear one of the kinder, gentler types of comedy. If we could have number one, please.
This is the plea of a poor little tropical fish. It's very sad, and we must be very quiet. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the clerk and the trombone player, the child on the street and the ultra elite, all write letters to the mayor. LaGuardia is most conscientious. He tries to grant everyone's wish. But they went him one better when he got a letter from somebody's tropical fish. Dear Mayor, the letter began, I'm writing as fish to man. Our tank's overheated and we're being treated like common sardines in a can. The way people watch us is quaint. Our privacy's something what ain't. So be a good fella, my dear Fiorella, and hear a poor fish's complaint. To be quite specific, the food is terrific. We're on the hay diet, you really should try it. It tastes like the hook, gee, I wish we could cook. The service is lousy, we have no back housey, and it's some spot to be in with no pot to cook in. The innocent spawners are hiding in corners, their love life is wearing, with human eyes staring. Why can't we have covers like those birdcage lovers? They're hidden each night till the morning sunlight, then brought out to bath with no questions asked. Dear Mayor, I've been very frightened, but you don't know life in a tank. Believe me, it's hellish, and you wouldn't relish to sleep in the water you drank. Now here's what we tropicals wish. Some bedrooms to give us ambition. Less public relations, and more comfort stations. Yours truly, a tropical fish.
Quick cut. Now that wasn't so bad, was it? Let's see where we're at. Much better. Along with the acceptance, we need to actually look at who made some of these records and what their relationship was to some of the other arts that were going around. Let's say you're in an institution of higher education. Chances are there are lots of PhD candidates out there in literature, English, something like that. And certainly a lot of female students now are interested in exploring the history of feminist literature, or at least literature written by women. One of those would be Dawn Powell, who just had her diaries published about a year ago. And she wrote quite a few plays and several novels during the 20s, 30s, 40s, and even into the 50s, I believe. Now, if that PhD candidate wanted to do a thorough job, she would have to know something about Dwight Fisk, because he's mentioned 30, 40 times in her diary. And we'd really be doing this student a disservice if somehow or other she was not able to connect with Dwight Fisk. So you can't see it too good because the focus isn't exactly perfect. But this is a Dwight Fisk on Gala. Gala was a very successful company in the mid-40s and onward. And she co-wrote one of his songs. They're not really songs. They're kind of vignettes, I guess you'd call them. Next. There we go. And Dwight also published a book. He made quite a few recordings at RCA Victor in 33 through 1936. Strangely, they were released with regular Victor 36,000 popular series 12-inch release numbers, but none that I've seen so far actually says Victor on it. They all say Fiskana. So whether they were originally scheduled for release on Victor and they chickened out at the last minute or what, I don't really know. And these were all dubbed, or at least some of them were dubbed onto Gala when he made the change to them in around 1943. But what you see here is an illustration from the book, had a foreword by Robert Benchley. So the lyrics to his little records were actually published and to pretty good reviews before he got to record them. So I'm not sure how that came about, but there it is. Oh, let's see. Another Gala. Charlie Drew at the Hotel Taft. Charlie Drew had very gentle style, about like the tropical fish thing we just heard. And he was at the Hotel Taft for about 40 years. I mean, he just lived there. And again, these well-heeled people would stream in and come to look and listen and have fun, gentle fun. That's a Green Label Gala. Gala is just a wonderful label to research. Radio. Okay, let me. But a gentle bang. All right, I actually did get to do some research and find out some facts about these things. And the state of New York is nice enough to maintain records of incorporations back to forever. And if you write them, they will actually send you a little summary of what they've got. And so far, the oldest record company that I can find that is actually a party record company is the Radio Record Company. Now, this is a later, probably 38 or 39 version. Could somebody focus that just a little bit? But it was originally incorporated in 1931, which is earlier than I'd really thought about party records being when I first got started. And you can't really see this, but it's Benny Bell, who of course is well known even among people who don't care too much about party records. He resurfaced in the mid-70s when some of the disc jockeys started playing his old things like Shaving Cream. They're just risque enough to be cute. I guess I better step out. Naturally, as I was getting ready to prepare this, the main record that I wanted to get photographed had disappeared. It's somewhere in a pile somewhere, I don't know. Anyway, Racy Records, this is about the oldest one, the oldest party record that I've been able to find. It has the same selection on both sides. It has no label on the second side. It's obviously a jukebox record. That's the only reason they would do that I can figure out. And as I was going through, I found a Music Publishers Protection Association list of ET firms who were paying royalties to the publishers. And one of them happens to have exactly the same address as this one, which is 1509 North Vine Street in Hollywood, California. So the Radio Transcription Corporation of America out there in Hollywood, I don't know, maybe some of you are familiar with it.
Also known as Transco.
Ah, Transco. Okay, well, guess what they were up to? Racy Records. And as I acquired some more of these, this one, you can't tell from the 50-50 cotton blend here. This is actually a laminated pressing. Definitely Columbia. Definitely West Coast. And right near the label in the runoff, HS 415 is written very clearly in a very distinctive hand in the runoff. Hollywood Hotshots over there has a different series of numbers, but it is written in exactly the same hand, so we can be pretty sure that it somehow emanates from the same place. I was just thrilled when I found this because I thought, I found, you know, this is the original source material. Great stuff. Put it on the turntable. Brrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr New York City at one of the main studios, likely ARC. They'd done up some test pressings, shipped them all the way out to Hollywood, dubbed them off to disguise their origins, I presume, and then issued them. This, like the other one, it's same selection on both sides. This one actually has a label on both sides, too, so it's obviously a step up.
Is this one live edited?
Yes, yeah. This is a... You can see the... Hello. I shut the mic off? No, I didn't. Oh, he did.
Leave it up. Around 1934, the Columbia sold the pressing plant to several of its former employees and became Athenone's ally.
Yes. Because ARC built their own plant out there at the same time. Anyway, I was real excited about this because I had another brainstorm. I started to feel like Sherlock Holmes as I'm going through and doing this. You can't really see it too clearly, but there is a master number over there, and it's LO, what is it, 319, something like that, 297, somewhere in through there, anyway. And I was thinking about it, and I suddenly remembered there was a Duke Ellington session out in Hollywood in 1936, December of 1936, several sessions, in fact. And son of a gun, they are in that same numbering series. So we can get an approximate date for these. Since they're dubs, they could have been made as early as 1931 from radio records, for all we know. But at least it gives you an upper limit, some way to estimate how old they are. There are no Duke Ellington sidemen so far that I've been able to find on any of these, unfortunately. They changed the label style a little bit. And these are no longer jukebox records. They actually went to the consumer market. There is a different selection on the other side. And that bright, shiny sticker you see is from a record shop in Pennsylvania. So obviously distribution is getting pretty good by that time. And which, well, that's Dr. Ease It In. That's one of the, you may have heard of Butter Beans and Susie, who made a lot of pretty risque recordings for OK in the 20s. I think the last session was in the early 30s, maybe 1930 or so. This, to my ears and to several others, is in fact Butterbeans and Susie doing something so raunchy even OK wouldn't have released it back in the 20s. Bruce Fletcher. There were a lot of female impersonators running around Los Angeles in these days. And Bruce seems to have been one of them. I found a reference to him in Variety magazine. They called him Breeze Fletcher, and they also called the Mills Blue Rhythm Band the Mills Blue Ribbon Band. So I think they had some new copy people there, and they were having a little trouble. This one doesn't have anything handwritten, so I can't identify the handwriting on the runoff, but it has the same problem that the LO matrix Matrix series has. Sometimes they are L-0319 or whatever, and sometimes they are LO317. The zero hops back and forth between an O and a zero. This one is the same way. It's an HO, and I think on the label it says HO, and in the wax it's H-0101 or 102. Nicely autographed by Bruce, anyway. This would come from probably 35 or so. Again, you can probably see it's a Columbia or Allied, perhaps by this time, pressing, laminated.
Ah, all the horsemen manure. All right. There's another identification problem. It says pure and simple on the label. Now, that gives me a really great clue as to who these might be. Male and female, not Burns and Allen. Beyond that, I really can't say who they are. But one of the problems with these things, you're not likely to find a lot of these Hollywood hotshots around. They're pretty old. People just don't take care of this sort of material. The idea is to buy it, drink a lot of beer, and have a good time with these things. If you bought them for the jukebox, the idea of having the same selection on both sides is because you knew this was a good item and you were going to play it and play it and play it. And when there was absolutely nothing left and people wouldn't put a nickel in the slot, you turned it over and did it again. But these were incredibly popular. Since there's no honor among thieves, they were dubbed and dubbed and dubbed forever. Sometimes they changed the titles. Sometimes the numbers would disappear. So that one was All the Horsemen Knew Her. Sometime in the 50s, it came out on Party Time as Who Rode My Sister, which sounds pretty bizarre. Another example, good humor seems to have followed the Hollywood hotshots. Some of them, you see, they still have the remnants of the Columbia ring in the label, but they're not laminated pressings anymore. I'm going to give it to Mary with Love. Is from our old friend Cliff Edwards, Ukulele Ike. If you're not familiar with him, he was very popular in the 20s and into the early 30s. Shortly after he made these, he became the voice of Jiminy Cricket for Walt Disney. He's the guy who sings When You Wish Upon a Star. This is very different material. Trust me on this. But it's interesting because the instrumentation is identical to a Brunswick recording session he had in 1933, October of 1933. And Brian Rust wrote some liner notes for an English LP called Listen to the Band, B-A-N-N-E-D. And along with everything else on the thing was basically issued recordings that were a little risque but couldn't be played on the BBC. He put on a couple of these as well, called them private issues and doesn't really give you anything helpful discographically, no numbers or anything, which would have been nice. This is another one of those LO jobs. But the instrumentation leads us to believe that it's probably an undocumented continuance of that Brunswick session. A couple days later he came back and made some more things, but the instrumentation was changed, so it's almost got to be October of 1933. But this was, judging by the LO number, this dub would have been made in probably early 1937. Whether it was released before that on some other label, I don't know. Logically, since some of this stuff was recorded in New York City, somebody must have been distributing it there. But so far, we've not come across anything. Same thing, but you notice the title is getting a little shorter, some of the numbers are starting to disappear. And of course, these people have no idea about grammar. They can't quite figure out what to do with an apostrophe. And this is about a third generation dub by this time. Too bad you can't see this. Obviously, my slide technique is not the greatest. This is a Bourbana record. We were graced with an excerpt from Ray Bourbon yesterday. He had his own label. You can't really see it, of course, but down at the bottom it says Piano Accompaniment by Bart Howard. Not a household name anymore, but he's still alive, living in New York City. And I called him up last December. He was still pretty spry. He's working on an album of his compositions at age 83 or 84. So he was a little tired and his memory wasn't great for something that was recorded over 60 years ago, but he did remember that he had made these records with Ray Bourbon in Hollywood sometime in 1935. Like I say, Bart Howard isn't exactly a household name anymore, but you've probably heard of one of his compositions called In Other Words, enjoyed some success when they retitled it Fly Me to the Moon. So for those of you who are into music history, this is probably one of his first records.
on my name tag. Well, that might work.
Maybe your shirt collar.
No, too slippery.
If you hold it, try to keep it in one place.
Try to keep it in one place.
All right.
Closer to me. All right. I had an FM radio like this once, you know, you just had to kind of, yeah, the reception's great, okay. All right. If you look on the runoff on this one,
are we going to try something new and different?
There you go.
Oh, super duper. Okay, great. In the runoff on this one, apparently the producers are Western Records Distributors. I haven't been able to find a name or address or anything for them, but they always put the WR number in the runoff, and so if you find Hollywood Hotshots or anything else that has no artist credit but a WR 700 number in the runoff, it's Ray Bourbon. Of course, he's usually pretty distinctive anyway, but sometimes he actually does some kind of straight stuff. Cocktail Time here is one of them. It's really rather low key for him. For those of you who aren't familiar with him, this is Ray Bourbon. When I found this LP, I just sort of stared at it. I'm a child of the 50s and 60s, and things like this just didn't happen. As far as I knew it. What did Mamie Eisenhower think of all this? Yeah. He was really very popular, very good. People like Bing Crosby and all the Hollywood celebrities would go out and see him. He's a very good performer, if you care for very campy material. I'm going to show you several of his things. He ended up on Hollywood Hot Shots. This is another one of those WR jobs, so it came from that original 1935 set. Musicraft, somehow or other, left-handedly got into the party record business for a little while. For some reason or other, he decided to do it under a pseudonym. I can't imagine he had a recording contract with anybody. Maybe these turned out during the ban. It was advisable to just disguise him a little bit. Liberty Music Shop picked up a few of his things. They did obviously cater to the gay bohemian crowd in New York City, since all they put out was a few party records and lots and lots and lots of show tunes. And that one's on a label called Imperial, put out by the Novelty Record Company. I don't know if it's any relation to the other Novelty Record Company. It may be. Joe Rhines was a very popular society orchestra leader. Again, he was catering to that same supper club crowd that Dwight Fisk and others were doing. But he also did some really risque things. In fact, he did a couple for Victor. If you can find a record called Taboo, Taboo, or My Love's a Country Gal, I Guess I'll Have to Marry Her. Pretty extreme stuff for 1932. And it's very surprising to see, you know, a mainstream label coming out with that sort of thing. Eli Oberstein, who I'll get to a little bit in a minute, was obviously closely involved with this. He was at Victor when the nasty things were recorded there in 32, and when he started his own Varsity in U.S. Records in 1939, he brought Joseph Rhines along with him. And it was deemed advisable to give him a new name, so he became John Ryan. And you'll find lots and lots of his Blue Label Varsity records. In 1940, ASCAP was getting ready to go on the warpath against the radio folks. They wanted more royalties. Obviously, radio didn't want to give it to them. So they were going to go on strike. And one of the first things you want to do when you go on the warpath is make yourself look good. So there was a big campaign to get rid of all of these people who were recording and writing nasty things and who were members of ASCAP. Huey Prince, you know, the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy and 4,000 other Boogie Woogie tunes, was one of the prime perpetrators. So what happened was
it was sort of reflected in the record companies as well as the radio people, and it was deemed a good idea to sort of calm things down again. So John Ryan got moved off of Varsity and onto John Ryan Records. And if you manage to look real close, it looks like it has a Chinese matrix number. That's not true. They just tried to X out the US number. Now, Eli, when he started up Varsity Records, had a big problem. He was really strongly tied to the jukebox industry. And of course, there was a problem collecting royalties from jukebox industry people because it was kind of hard to tell exactly how many plays you were getting out of it. So they made a special deal with him that he would have a label that would include a non-commercial for home use clause on the label. Now, a lot of the other record companies were putting it on the sleeves that the records came in, but they insisted that he do it on the record. He moved into the old ARC Brunswick Studios at 1776 Broadway, and in the 1775 studio, which had also been ARC, was a company called Amor, A-M-M-O-R, which I believe stood for something like Automated Music Machine Organization or something, strictly jukebox. So that's probably where they got the idea that old Eli was kind of tied to the jukebox industry. So when you see Party Records that carry this very official sounding thing about non-commercial use and home use only, which you would sort of figure, well, it's not going to be anything like that. These give me at least the hint that possibly Eli has something to do with them. So we have Highlight and Top Hat. These are very common. You see a lot of Top Hats. They started out, they would take one old Varsity side, like She Had to Go and Lose It at the Astor, which was very notorious in 1939. Sold 150,000 copies for Eli, but got him into a lot of hot water. And they would take one of those nasty things and put a polka or something on the other side to stretch it out. And the later issues, they seem to have recorded new stuff. Party Record, just plain old Party Record, no bones about it. But again, it has that warning about non-commercial use in homes. Party Record Company Incorporated. We saw a Musicraft Party Record a little while ago with the same laughing face, goofy thing on the, that it says trademark registered. I haven't been able to find any registration for it. But for a very brief time in 1941, it was in fact incorporated. There is a record of it in the state of New York. So this one certainly dates from 1941, which would correspond to, I think Eli was doing Elite Records about that time. Same sort of material, same laughing face, but they're not incorporated. We're on a red label. I don't know if these are, in fact, Musicraft, and they were still being a little coy and timid about putting their name on the label, or if there's a third party involved, all doing the same stuff. And some of this then migrated onto Gala. Once again, Musicraft Party Record. You can sort of tell by the outside that it corresponds very closely to their regular issue material. So you can sort of date it from the label style. Are we running out of time? Alrighty. Since we're running out of time, I guess I won't even play Dwight Fisk for you. Another kinder, gentler thing. This was recorded in England in the HMV studios, so he's definitely high class. Okay? I'll be happy to take some questions. But I can't see you in the dark. Yes, sir.
You didn't mention Pearl, which is not the only thing that I've ever met.
Well, Pearl was about 4 pages down, I'm afraid. We're kind of working our way through it. Larry Vincent started Pearl Records in 1946. Because he had tried to join ASCAP at exactly the time that they were doing his big cleanup. They say Cincinnati on the later purple label, so I assume there's some kind of tie-in with King Records. The very first ones are red labels with a hand-stamped logo, Pearl, on them, very primitive looking. Those were just distributed up and down the Mississippi Valley. You don't see many of those, but the purple labels, very, very popular. I used to work in Chicago, was a big hit. It was picked up by several other record companies. The Freckle song was also very big. So Pearl, Top Hat, the party record companies are quite common. You'll see those all over the place. Yes? Lil Johnson? Okay, there are lots and lots of very risque things that show up in both the country series. You've got the Sweet Violet Boys and people like that, and certainly in the blues line. There was a blues record of Sweet Violets that Variety said had sold 150,000 copies in 1935, when Bing Crosby would be lucky to sell 20,000. Yes?
I've been telling people that you would tell about the crepitation contest, so you better just tell us.
Let's get to the crepitation contest. Oh, let's see. That's vital stuff. That is one of the most enduring, popular records. It has this wonderful combination of totally sophomoric material done by very, very, very competent people. In fact, they were Canadian broadcast people. It was done very, very professionally. Let's see. It was done, Sidney S. Brown was the narrator. He was very well known in Canada. I mean, he was a real person. This isn't just made up. He used his own name. It was put together in 1940, and basically they were just going to distribute it to, you know, the fun people who came to the conventions and that sort of thing. Jules Lipton was Sidney's producer at the CBC, and he also produced this. It was recorded at Red Foster's Studios on Alcorn Avenue in Toronto. It was done on a 16-inch lacquer. Just a holiday giveaway. Reportedly, it was played at a big party on New Year's Eve in 1943, where an admiral heard it and decided that the best thing for the troops' morale would be to have this pressed up and sent to the ships. So basically, you've got some under-the-counter V-discs here. Later on, it was dubbed down to 378 sides on Humor, which existed from 47 to 52, so if you find a Humor 10-inch version of it, that's what it's from. Any further questions, I'll have to take individually.
Thanks.
I will be available. You can find me.
Okay, our next speaker is